How long have you been in New York?
Less than 24 hours. Got in last night about 6.
Well, you look reasonably well adjusted.
Oh, really?
You look reasonably normal. And,
Yes, and so does New York. Although the traffic last night was a kick, you know. This is someplace between Europe and the West Coast when it comes to traffic. You know, it's not Rome, it's not Cairo, it's not that bad, it's not Haiti, but it's someplace else other than California, the way people drive here and they cut in and so forth and so on.
Yeah, my mother and father live in Houston, Texas, and they are always complaining about the freeways and the traffic.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to visit them in Houston and I drive around, it's wonderful.
Yes.
And I don't know what they're complaining about, because I have literally spent 45 minutes going around the block in Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah. They have no my family lives in Dallas, and some of them live in Houston, too. I haven't been on the Houston freeways in years, but I know how smooth everything works in Texas, because the whole culture there is the automobile culture, you know. But I heard that in Houston, that Houston is growing so fast that people are taking 2 hours to get from the airport to downtown Houston, and that people are jumping out of trucks on the freeway and settling disputes with guns.
That's true.
That report?
That's true, but the airport is naturally 2 hours away from downtown Houston.
Oh, I see.
And it's in the city limits.
God.
It's incredible. It's so far away. It's like, actually, when I go to Houston now, I fly into the old airport. It's called Hobby.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the equivalent of LaGuardia here. Mm-hmm. And so I fly into that little airport, which is much closer in, and it's better than driving the 2 hours from the other big airport.
Yeah. I don't even remember where I flew in when I went there. I went there on a book tour in 76.
Mm-hmm. What an unusual a book. Tell me how the correct pronunciation is.
I just pronounce it Lestat.
Lestat. Lestat.
Mm-hmm. I made up the name, so that's the way I say it.
Well, I that's the definitive pronunciation then.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about yourself. I know you were born in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your early days and your literary influences, if any, in your household.
Well, I grew up in New Orleans. I left there, actually, when I was a teenager. Excuse me. But it was a household, I think, dominated by parents that loved music and loved literature. And the only authors I remember being a profound influence at that point were Edgar Allan Poe and Charles Dickens. I mean, we had their books by the pound in our house, and I read them when I was a kid. Later, we moved to Texas, and then I came out to California. I've lived there for 25 years, so I'm really, at this point, a San Franciscan. But New Orleans is always there when I write. I mean, all I have to do is sit down at the computer keyboard, and I'm suddenly surrounded by those crumbling mansions and those gardens and those, you know, flowers bursting through wrought iron fences, and that particular type of gloom, and a splendid gloom that New Orleans has. So I think that was the strongest influence, maybe more than anything I read. It was that wonderful, sensuous, semi-tropical climate and that beautiful old architecture, the antebellum mansions and the old Spanish townhouses, all of that.
Yeah, there's something eerily murky and decayed about New Orleans that makes it very romantic, a very romantic atmosphere for writers. And so many writers have used New Orleans for their locales. Robert Stone, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed I was talking to Elmore Leonard, who is a Detroit area writer, and he was born in New Orleans. And his new novel.
Leonard was. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And his new novel, I don't think he's ever put a novel there before, but he's putting his newest novel. They're all the same. All of his novels are the same. All his characters are the same. They have different names.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Maybe a mustache and a different name, but it's all the same character, but he's putting the locale there.
Mm-hmm.
And on and on and on. I think New Orleans has drawn people. Tennessee Williams, and off the top of my head, I can't remember the others, but so many of them have gone there. When did you leave New Orleans to go to Dallas, was it?
I left at 15, and going to Dallas was like stepping into television. I mean, it was like finding America, because growing up down there was like growing up in the Caribbean or something. I mean, it's, I guess, one of the most foreign places in the United States. And then suddenly I was in suburban America outside of Dallas, Texas, and I discovered the wall-to-wall carpeted world. And it was a dazzling revelation. I kind of fell in love with all the luxuries of American life, and then at the same time I missed New Orleans. I missed the corruption and the ambience and everything else.
Where did you go to school?
Well, where did I go to school? In New Orleans?
No, where did you go to? What was your higher education?
Oh, I went out to California to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, it was very hard, I think, to put yourself through college in Texas. There were state colleges in small towns where the wages were very low, and I really had to work my way through completely. So I went out to San Francisco, and I found the perfect place where you could go to night school and where you could work in the day. And I went to a number of schools out there before finally getting an MA in creative writing from San Francisco State University. I even went to UC Berkeley for a little while. But I got out fairly fast. It's no place for a writer.
You got an MA in
creative writing.
So you knew quite early on that this is something you wanted to do.
It took me a while. I went to college off and on for about 6 or 7 years. I meandered through different majors. I just read what I wanted to read. I wandered around sort of looking for myself in a cliched fashion, like many young people in California. I was always writing something somewhere in the back room. And then finally, after years of this, I guess about 6 years, then I committed to the MA in creative writing and finished up.
What did you have to do to earn the MA? Did you have to write a novel?
Yes, I wrote a novel. That was my master's thesis, actually. And it's a novel that's never been published, and it's still lying there on the shelf at San Francisco State, and it's a little different from anything else I ever wrote. I didn't write Interview with a Vampire till about 5 years after that.
Your first novel was Cry to Heaven, your first published novel.
No, Interview with a Vampire was actually it. And The Vampire Lestat is a sequel, really, to Interview with a Vampire, coming 10 years later. Interview with a Vampire was published in 1976.
Uh-huh. All right, tell me a little bit about that and what you had indicated a moment ago that you were addicted to Edgar Allan Poe and,
mm-hmm.
and writers like that when you were growing up. So obviously this genre was in your mind. But tell me about how you developed the idea of The Vampire and Interview with the Vampire. What led you to write that?
It started absolutely as a whim. I was sitting there at the typewriter. I thought, what would it be like if you could interview a vampire? What would it be like if he really told you the truth about his existence? And that was really all I began with, that experiment. Suppose he's here, I'm asking him questions, he's telling me the answers. Of course, I became him, and I told the answers. And what evolved, I think, was the vampire story that I had always wanted to read and had never been able to find. I mean, no movie, no book, no short story about vampires had ever satisfied me because they focused on the victim. It was always the victim's point of view of this mysterious figure that stepped out of the shadows, struck like lightning, and then went back into the shadows. So suddenly I was with that figure, you know, and I went home at night to the coffin with him. So that was really all there was to it. You know, there wasn't a lot of conscious thought. Like, I didn't sit down and say, well, I'm going to write an allegory in which these vampires are going to be metaphors for all of us because they're lonely, you know, and they're locked out of life the way we all feel. None of that was in my head, though later, when I look back on the novel, I saw a lot of those different things. Because I think even in the most bizarre fantasy or the most bizarre supernatural fiction, you really write about yourself and you write about the people you know and you write about your own fears and your own hang-ups, to use a cliche.
In effect, you have humanized the vampire, mm-hmm. haven't you?
Yeah, well, he would have to be human, I think. I mean, one reason he interested me when I don't think any of the other monsters of the supernatural world did was because he does look and talk and walk and act like a human being. He's the monster with a human face. That fascinated me. I felt like, what must be the loneliness, you know, what must be the isolation? What really happens in the mind of somebody that's immortal? I mean, none of us can know that. It's always going to be an act of imagination. But in general, I think writers have cheated us on that score, that they've over and over again given us novels and stories in which there's an immortal figure, and the immortal figure turns out to be adult. I mean, you know, over and over again, immortals are presented as people who are simply longing for a lost love. You know, they're pining away for eternity. I mean, like Aisha, the famous novel by H. Rider Haggard, apparently the only thing on her mind is, you know, finding the recreation of the lover that she had thousands of years before. It seemed to me that if you were immortal, something else would be going on upstairs. You know, you might be falling apart, you might be going mad, but you'd have some other take on watching everything around you crumble into ruin and fashion change and music change and painting change and all of that. You'd have to think something else. And then, you know, I wanted to get into that.
Two other books followed your first book, then, The Interview with the Vampire. They were The Feast of All Saints and Cry to Heaven.
Right.
Tell me about those. How did they differ from Interview with the Vampire?
Well, they're completely different in that they don't have any supernatural element. But in a way, they're very, very similar in that they're also books about outcasts. I mean, if you do see vampires as metaphorical outcasts, if you see them as magnifications of the rest of us, the Free People of Color in Feast of All Saints were also outcasts. They were mulattoes and octoroons and quadroons that lived in Louisiana before the Civil War. They were a class that had evolved out of the illicit relationships between white planters and beautiful quadroon mistresses. They were the children of these, you know, the offspring of these relationships. And they were people that lived right in the middle of the city of New Orleans, had a great deal of money, were educated, sent their children to Europe for education and so forth, yet they didn't really have any, they didn't have any of the legal rights that white people had. And they were locked out of society, in essence. They couldn't do anything really to influence society except as artists. So I saw them as magnificent outcasts. I mean, here was another set of outcasts, like the vampires, that I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about their dilemma. In Cry to Heaven, the subject was the castrati opera singers of the 18th century, and they were the same thing. They were boys who were castrated when they were 6 or 7 in order to preserve beautiful soprano voices, which the Italians, for all their worship of the macho male, actually very much loved this very high-pitched soprano voice, and they particularly loved to see castrati play kings and gods on the stage. They associated that high-pitched voice and that pure soprano with virility and power, actually. But anyway, they had created this class of human beings called the castrati, some of whom became superstars, like our super rock stars of today, and yet they were outcasts. They couldn't legally marry. They certainly couldn't have any children. They were capable of sexual relationships, but they were freaks. And that fascinated me. So to me, they're all connected, but you see, they're all different.
Well, meanwhile, I would assume that the vampire kept running through your mind because you decided to go back to it and an even more ambitious book about the vampire than your first. Mm-hmm. So tell me why you decided not to let the vampire drop.
Well, I think with any of my books, the characters become so alive to me, the world becomes so real, that I can see sequels to all of them. I can see the ongoing stories of all the characters. And that was true of Interview with the Vampire. I ended it with sort of a cliffhanger. I ended it with, we knew that the boy interviewer was going to go seek out the vampire Lestat now that he had heard Lewis's story, the vampire Lewis. And it was really just a matter of getting ready to go back to that world, you know, and also a matter of feeling that I finally had something to add. I didn't want to just write another vampire story that repeated and rehashed all the things that were in Interview with the Vampire. I wanted to take it a big step further. You know, the vampires in these books have questions like, where do we come from? Why are we here? Why are we vampires? And in Interview with the Vampire, there's no answer. Nobody finds an answer. And the despair of the main character comes out of that fact, that there doesn't seem to be any explanation for his existence any more than there is an explanation for ours. And I wanted to go further with Lestat. I wanted Lestat to turn up some real, juicy facts and truths about where the vampires came from, not the ultimate answer.
I don't like the way you said juicy.
Puns with this word are inescapable.
Well, Lestat wakes up in New Orleans. It's 1929, I believe, right?
Well, he goes to sleep in New Orleans in 1929, and he wakes up in 1985.
That's right. And,
or 84.
You certainly have a sweeping story. He wakes up and in the modern age and goes back to his earliest origins. The conclusion of the book is when he is on the stage in San Francisco, and I noticed that the story is not going to end.
No, there'll be a third book, but I don't know what's going to be in the third book yet. I have to go away and let all of that brew, you know. I mean, I have some ideas, but I don't know exactly what will happen yet.
Well, you've also made the encounters that Lestat has with his various victims extremely erotic. Mm-hmm. One wouldn't think that, but these bloody encounters become very sensual. Mm-hmm. And I assume that was a very deliberate effort on your part.
Yes, it was. But I think that the idea of those encounters being erotic has always been connected with a vampire. I mean, it didn't start with my books. I mean, Bram Stoker's Dracula, it's the same thing. I think we're supposed to see Dracula as this incredible sexual force that's menacing Mina and Lucy in the book. And an earlier story, a wonderful story by Sheridan Le Fanu called Carmilla, a beautiful vampire story has an enormous erotic content. There's a woman vampire in there who seduces another woman, and that's been made into many, many movies. You frequently turn on the late show and see an Italian vampire movie with two beautiful women in a four-poster bed, and that's right out of Carmilla, you know. I mean, all those movies are based on Sheridan Le Fanu's story. So it wasn't something new with me. But I can't say I thought of those other works. I was simply asking myself, well, what would it be like? And it seemed to me that the kill would have to be, or the taking of the victim's blood would have to be this tremendously sensuous thing. It would be a great embrace. There would be rapture. For the vampire, there would be this incredible experience of taking not just the blood, but the life of that person, the heartbeat, the mind, all of that. I mean, it seemed built in.
I just assume not do it myself.
Oh, really? You don't think you'd become a vampire if you had the chance?
As you wrote The Vampire Lestat, how did you plan the novel? Was it pretty well blocked out in your mind, or
no,
rather spontaneous as you wrote page after page?
No, I don't really block things out too well, or if I do block them out, the scaffolding collapses very soon. Things just evolve. You know, one thing happens, then another. I'll be lying in bed at night, an idea will pop into my head. I'll dash back to the computer completely. That's why working on a computer is a very good thing, because you can go back and revise so much. Nothing stands between you and what you want to do, you know. No mechanical problem, basically. And I work very much that way. Like, you know, write a chapter in one day in which something happens, and then get the idea the next day that it should all be completely changed. I was going to say revamped, but I'm trying to...
What kind of computer do you use?
Don't laugh when I say the name of my computer. It's an Apricot. It's a wonderful mm-hmm. English computer, leading computer in England. It's terrifically fast, and little 3.5-inch disks. Mm-hmm. But to me, this is one of the greatest things that's ever happened to writers. It gives us the flexibility of working with a pencil and an eraser, and the speed, and you know, twice the speed of a typewriter.
Well, what happens if you write a chapter, and then you're well into the second chapter, and you find a couple of pages that really belong in the first chapter? Can
you
shuffle these pages around easily?
You can very easily do that. You can just mark those pages off and copy them over to another disk, then take the later chapter, put that in the computer, and then copy those pages into the later chapter. You can move them anywhere you want, really. You can swap them around. That's what I mean about once you work this way, nothing stands between you and what you want to do. I mean, when you work on a typewriter, there's always that drudgery, that enormous task of retyping those pages, of just keeping things in order, of not dropping something off your desk, of, you know, getting the pagination all wound up. All of that goes away with the computer. And it's like something that will just silently and almost angelically implement what you want done. Once you know how to use it, you know, you have to master it.
How did you learn to use it?
Oh, just sat there and read the manual and drank coffee and practiced until I got it straight. You know, I mean, anyone can do it, really. Any writer can. If all the writers knew what the computer could do, they would switch over. They would just sit down and they would make it. But it's like you don't believe it, you know, when you hear about it. Then later when you start working that way, you want to go tell everybody. Look, this
is
it.
You're a believer, all right. There are a lot of people who are holding out.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
They just, no, they're not going to do it. Yeah. Michael Crichton, do you know him at all?
No, I know his work. I mean, I know of him, but I haven't really.
Well, he wrote a very interesting book. I had him in and we talked about it. I think that was also published by Knopf.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the title. It was a couple of years ago.
I think I know the book.
It was about computers. I can't
computers
remember the name.
Computers and writers, yeah.
Yeah, but it was quite interesting. I had never worked with a computer. Now we have computers everywhere here.
I was looking at them as we went through the station.
I'm sure they're not as fun as the Apricot.
I don't know.
These are workhorses, but and they store a tremendous amount of material, but mm-hmm. they're not mm-hmm. very much fun to work with.
Really? Well, I think when once you really get used to a computer and you get used to entering the information from that keyboard, things happen in your mind. I mean, you change as a writer. You're able to do things that maybe you never would have thought of doing before. And you have to, I think your mind has to meet that challenge. It takes about 2 years to realize what this thing can really do, so that you begin to use its whole potential. Because what it does is it forces you to come up to it. You know, it says, I can do anything you want now, so think, you know, what do you want me to do?
You
know.
So you really have a stake in the computer now.
Well, I think it's terrific. I mean, I think the best way, I mean, when writers wrote with pencils and erasers, they had a freedom that they lost with the typewriter. They lost because of that mechanical step. It put a distance there. And now we're back to that freedom.
What's it like? Do you live right in San Francisco?
Yes, I do.
And you have two children, is that right?
I have one child.
One child?
Mm-hmm.
What's it like living in San Francisco and, say, in your neighborhood? You're the lady on the block who writes about vampires. What's it like?
Well, I live in the Castro District of San Francisco, which is really a downtown existence. And for me, it's absolutely wonderful. I'm an absolute hermit. I just write all day long. And so I love to go out at 5 o'clock and see all the people on the street, you know, all the people coming home, going to dinner in restaurants and shops and so forth. I love all that hustle and bustle and noise because I'm so isolated, you know, most of the time. And, you know, it's just a very urban existence, the kind of existence you can only live in a place like San Francisco or New York or the French Quarter in New Orleans. You don't need an automobile. You can get everything you want from a copy of the New York Times to Chinese food to an exotic sausage within one block.
So it's not like going to the backyard and having a barbecue and talking with a neighbor over the back fence.
Absolutely not. It's the absolute opposite of a suburban existence. And I love that. I love jumping on the metro and going downtown in 10 minutes and shopping and then being back home in 10 minutes.
So you have a great deal of anonymity that people have in urban environments.
No, I'm recognized all over the place, but it's fine. You know, I don't mind it. I mean, people, I think, are very respectful of writers' privacy, basically. You know, they really don't. Once they know you're a writer, they really don't want to disturb you. If they come to your front door unexpected, you know, they'll just tap and say, "Are you writing?" And if you say, "Yes, I am," they understand. I mean, that's the way I've always found them to be. So, in a sense, their knowing presents no problem whatsoever.
I think Raymond Carver puts a sign on his front door in mm-hmm. Syracuse. I think just a sign says, "No."
Yes. Well, I can understand that. But I haven't really had that problem. As a matter of fact, I have a listed phone number, and I get calls from all over the country about my work, and I really love to talk to people when they call.
Do you really?
Yes, I do.
People just call you out of the blue?
Yes, they do. Yeah.
And well, what do they ask you?
Mainly they call to say how they felt about the book, and they're frequently very, very generous, and they don't stay on the phone very long. You know, they're great. They just say, "I just wanted to tell you that I read Interview with a Vampire, and I really loved it," something like this. And it really is wonderful. I mean, I'll be sitting there, say, blocked or something, or depressed, and suddenly the phone will ring, and it'll be somebody from New Jersey, saying they just discovered the book. And it's terrific, you know.
That your husband, Stan Rice, is a poet. Does he also teach?
Yes, he's the chairman of the Creative Writing Department at San Francisco State. He's taught there for years. Mm-hmm. We both went to school there and both got our degrees there, and he went on to become a member of the faculty.
How has your writing, and particularly your success with the Vampire series, affected his life?
Oh, it's hard to say. I could never sum it up in a few words. We both just sort of live and breathe writing, you know. And now our 7-year-old son is turning out to be the same way. He can read very, very well for 7, and he loves books as much as we do. Our house is so full of books that we recently had to open up the basement and put 25-foot bookshelves on the wall, if you can believe it. We have an enormous library. I think we're fortunate in that we're all involved with the same things. You know, I imagine it's very stimulating to be married to someone in another field. I mean, that would have its advantages too, but it's wonderful for us all to be, I think, focused in that way and sharing each other's experiences.
Is he also a critic of yours?
Yes, he's a very valuable critic to me. He reads my manuscripts and he gives me terrific, terrific feedback. He's a very special, very pure kind of reader. You know, commercial concerns mean nothing to him. He reads the books as a poet would read them. Mm-hmm. He comes down very hard on anything he thinks is false or, not finished or something like that. So he's very, very important to me.
You have quite a nice little literary establishment in San Francisco, don't you? There's Alice Adams and Diane Johnson and Herbert Gold.
Yeah, I've heard we have as many writers there as practically Boston and New York or something, or we're the second in the nation. You know, we have quite a few. I don't think there's any organized community, though. I think most of us out there are loners. We see each other only very occasionally.
Well, Anne Rice, it's certainly an unusual book, The Vampire Lestat. It's going to surprise a lot of people who did not read Interview with a Vampire, and if they haven't read it, I know they'll want to go back and read that one, too. Certainly an engaging person for a young woman who writes about vampires. And I really appreciate your coming in and talking to me because I can see you're enthusiastic about it and as apparently enthusiastic as getting those calls at 3 o'clock in the morning. I hope they're not collect.
Oh, they don't come at 3 o'clock in the morning.
I hope they don't come collect either.
No, they don't come collect. They don't come at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they don't come from vampires either.
Aww.
10 years. 10 years, and not a single vampire has called.
That's too bad.
10 years. But I keep hoping, you know, if there is one out there, maybe sooner or later I'll get a nice letter on black stationery or some little word of encouragement that I got it right, you know.
Anne Rice, thank you very much.
My pleasure.